Campus FM presents a talk as part of the Work in Progress seminar series entitled On Performing Statues. This talk is delivered by Dr. John Mitchell, reader in anthropology at University of Sussex.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the second seminar in the series Work in Progress in the Social Sciences, the second seminar in this academic year's series. Before introducing tonight's speaker, I'd like to inform you that next week we have the renowned ethnomusicologist, Professor Martin Stokes of Oxford University, as the guest of the Mediterranean Institute, and he will be speaking to the Work in Progress seminar on the topic Music and the Global Order. That is next Thursday, 2nd April, 6 to 8 p.m., here in room 124. Well, now let me introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. John Mitchell. He is known to many of you. We welcome him back to Malta. Dr. Mitchell is reader in social anthropology at the University of Sussex. From 1992 to 1994, he did his fieldwork in St. Paul Shipwreck Parish in Valletta, focusing particularly on the issue of Maltese cultural identity and also on the issue of Maltese ritual, the meaning of Maltese festa and other Maltese rituals. This led to his monograph, Ambivalent Europeans, published in 2002. With myself, he published an edited volume, Powers of Good and Evil, Commodities, Moralities, and Popular Belief. With Gary Armstrong in 2008, he has just published Global and Local Football, which is an analysis of Maltese football in such a way as to suggest the relevance of sport and the understanding of sport to our understanding of Maltese society and politics. I think we should also mention his article on the ritual process in Malta, a very fine-grained analysis of festa, which referred to the theories of various ritual theorists in order to produce his own theory of ritual. And this article is Ritual Structure and Ritual Agency. And you can find it in the journal Social Anthropology in 2004. From 2000 to 2002, John was the president of the European Association of Social Anthropologists. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome John tonight, and he will be speaking on the intriguing topic, performing statues.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul. what I'm going to do is read out a paper. It's a chapter that I've just written for a book that's coming out next year called The Matter of Belief, I believe, on material religion, religion and material culture, edited by David Morgan. In the States, it's kind of pointing towards new research that I'm kind of hoping to do, but also pointing backwards quite a lot. So anybody who's familiar with my stuff, there'll be lots of familiar stuff once again. Okay, performing statues. I'm going to start by a quote, reading a quote from a blogspot accessed earlier this month. Today, 16th of February 2009, at about 12:55 p.m., Catherine Caruana, wife of Angelique, noticed that the statue of the Immaculate Conception that they have at home had once again wept tears of blood. These tears had issued from the left eye of the statue. Also materializing on the said statue are salt, a sign that the Christian is to be the salt of the earth, and oil, a sign of healing. That was posted by Theotokos at 10:18 p.m. Angelique Caruana is a seer and at the centre of a small but significant devotional movement here in Malta. On the 23rd of January 2006, he noticed that the statue that his wife had bought a few days earlier of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary was weeping tears of blood. On the 21st of April of the same year, Angelique began to receive messages and see visions of the Virgin Mary, initially in his house and at prayer meetings, then at the hilltop Neolithic temple site of Burj in Nadur. Mary had instructed him to go to Borgin Nador, as she wished it to become a place of prayer, pilgrimage, and conversion. Since then, and until now, weekly prayer meetings have been organised at the site, with Angelique frequently attending to receive messages and see visions of the Virgin. The statue has continued to weep blood, which has been confirmed by DNA testing to be Angelique's own blood, and to secrete other substances, including oil and salt. Angelique is a member of the prayer group Mir, at which his early communications from and visions of Mary took place. Mir is the Croatian word for peace, and the group was established after a group of Maltese pilgrims returned from Medjugorje, the town in Bosnia and Herzegovina where visions of the Virgin had been reported since 1981. Despite the church's unwillingness to acknowledge the authenticity of the claims to visions in Medjugorje, it's grown into an affluent and influential pilgrimage site for European and American Catholics. Zimdaz Swartz sees direct links between the visions at Medjugorje and those at the Irish village of Melleray in 1985, which had, like Angelique's visions, been preceded by a pilgrimage to Medjugorje. After the Maltese pilgrims had returned home, they asked their spiritual director, a Capuchin priest, to hold prayer meetings, and Mir meetings were soon to attract up to 500 participants. The emphasis of these meetings is conversion, a strong theme of the Medjugorje Virgin's message. The theme is also central to the messages received by Angelique. Jina sultana tal paci o tal familia, conversioni, conversioni fil familia. I am the queen of peace in the family, conversion, conversion, conversion in families. Jina sultana tal paci ul familia, conversioni fil Iran, fil Australia, fil China, fil Russia, fil America. I am the queen of peace in the family, conversion in Iran, Australia, China, Russia, and America. Now, a number of explanations have been proposed by scholars of religion for the emergence of movements such as the one that's developed around Angelique and Borgin Nador. Visions are often linked to periods of religious and social uncertainty. For both believers and analysts, the appearance of saintly figures, and particularly the Virgin Mary, is evidence of broader socio-religious concern about the state of the world or the authority of the Catholic Church. The Virgin's call for conversion in the family and her choice of Iran, China, Russia, and America seem to confirm this. In contemporary Malta, there are deep-seated anxieties about the potential erosion of family values and disintegration of the family as an institution by processes of Europeanization and modernization. The list of countries reveals concerns over international geopolitical stability, with the superpowers targeted alongside Iran, which came to occupy a particular position, of course, in the United States President George W. Bush's axis of evil. Australia, of course, has a particular place in the Maltese imagination as a prominent destination of Maltese emigration. The call to convert these areas may stem not only from a wish to spread peace, but also from a more millennial concern to prepare the way for Christ's second coming, a theme that again is common to many Virgin visions. Mart Bax links the emergence and development of Medjugorje to interordinary conflict within the Catholic Church, conflict between different orders, and the politics of local administrative authority and autonomy. William Christian, appropriately named, in a series of books on Spanish visions, has developed a similar argument, exploring the subtle intersection of local, national, and transnational interests that feed into competing interpretations and attributions of vision phenomena, from conflict between holy orders, politics of local anti-clericalism, and relations between local church and the Vatican. Now, this paper is less concerned with these sociological explanations of vision phenomena than with their phenomenology. What's going on when people have experiences of the supernatural? Likewise, I'm less concerned with the visions and locutions or inner voices than with the related and, in Angelique's case, preceding phenomenon of moving statues. Statues in popular Catholicism link the material world and the immaterial, the natural and the supernatural, in ways that resolve inherent tensions within Catholic theology between immanence and transcendence. or the closeness and distance of God and the saints. Saints are close to people because they can intervene into everyday life and involve themselves in people's lives, helping to solve personal, social, even military problems. They can also intercede, petitioning God on behalf of a particular person or group. They're distant because the possibility of such intervention and intercession is unpredictable. And although, to quote Perniola, they're lurking in everyday space-time, ready to intervene, they simultaneously occupy an eternal space-time of heaven. This dual temporality is a central feature of sainthood. After all, saints are not merely supernatural entities derived from mythology, but also historical figures whose lives can be empirically confirmed. They are hybrids, part historical, part mythological, part everyday, part transcendental, part supernatural, part natural. Statues of saints both communicate and resolve this duality, or these dualities. Material culture has been at the centre of Catholic understandings of the saints since the emergence of saint cults in late antiquity. From the 3rd to 4th century of the Common Era, pilgrimage centres developed around living saints, often hermit holy men, and at the sites of the tombs of Christian martyrs. Such sites were places where the religious could experience the power, or potentia, of the saints through a spiritual engagement with their presence, or presentia. The notion of presentia mediated the duality of distance and proximity inherent in sainthood. And to quote from Peter Brown, the carefully maintained tension between distance and proximity at pilgrimage sites ensured one thing, presentia, the physical presence of the holy, whether in the midst of a particular community or in the possession of a particular individual, was the greatest blessing that a late antique Christian could enjoy. The presentia on which such heady enthusiasm focused was the presence of an invisible person. Presentia, however, was not limited to the pilgrimage site. Saints could also be present in the smallest relics of their lives. These could be, and again, quote this time from Patrick Geary, these could be particles of clothing or objects associated with the saint during their lives, particles of dust or vials of oil collected at the site of their tombs, or actual portions of their bodies. Relics permitted a portable presentia that by the early medieval period, roughly 750 to 1150 CE, had fueled a pan-European circulation of relics. Based on the principle that every church altar should contain a relic of a saint, relics were exchanged as gifts, stolen and sold in an intense period of sacred commerce. Saints were also present in statues. As three-dimensional depictions of saints' bodies, their significance was not merely symbolic or representational. They didn't stand for or symbolise the saint, nor communicate saintliness from a distance. Rather, they brought saints into being, generating a presence, a presentia, and a power, potentia, of their own and of the saint. To this extent, they achieved the same combination of presence and power as the pilgrimage site or relic. And indeed, they later became objects of pilgrimage in and of themselves. As Liz James has argued of Byzantine Constantinople, statues were perceived on both the popular and the intellectual level as animated, dangerous, and talismanic. Animated by the presence of the saint, dangerous because they had the power to protect themselves against attack, as in the example of the image of the Virgin that retaliated against a man who threw a stone at her by crushing his head, and talismanic because they also had the power to protect those devoted to them. Now, although I don't wish to suggest that nothing has changed in Catholic thought since Byzantine times, the significance of saints' statues as manifestations of power and presence has endured. In contemporary Malta, statues are an important feature of popular religiosity. They adorn the insides of houses and churches, are carried in procession around villages and towns during the frequent religious feasts, and are in some cases thought to have miraculous curative properties. Statues are not merely objects, they're objects that are engaged with and interacted with, particularly on ritual occasions, and it's through the performance of ritual that their power and presence is confirmed. If statues have the power to influence the world through miraculous curative properties, for example, then this suggests that they have agency, the capacity to act. Alfred Gell explored the agency of objects and artifacts in his posthumously published Art and Agency. The book rejects semiological or symbolic approaches to art and those rooted in comparative aesthetics, which seek to locate the meaning of a particular artifact within a given cultural system or system of meaning and value. Rather, he locates the power of art, and here his argument goes beyond art, strictly speaking, to encompass broader material culture. The power of art is located in its ability to act upon the person, or what he describes as the patient. Using the relatively trivial example of the anthropomorphizing of motor cars, what he wryly calls vehicular animism, Gell demonstrates artifacts' possession of intentional capacities to initiate causal events by breaking down, for example. And we've all been in the position where we've talked to our cars and chastised them for breaking down. And bikes. And indeed parts of our body. This capacity is projected onto objects through a cognitive module of theory of mind, which attributes psychological intentionality to social persons. The theory of mind is central to human social life. Where an object or artifact is also considered a social person, as in the case of saint statues, this understanding of intentionality is extended to the artifact. The thrust of Gell's argument is that it's perfectly normal for a person to do this. Attributing agency to objects is a perfectly routine part of people's everyday encounters with the material world around them. And it's particularly so when artifacts incorporate the human figure. If the power of the saint's statues can be attributed to their agency, their presence is achieved through performance. Statues are not merely looked upon, but also engaged with. And this engagement is accentuated during festive occasions, when statues are removed from their daily position in glass-fronted niches in churches and processed around a parish. During this time, statues become animated. They are spoken to directly, they're touched and made to dance along the streets. They're performed with, generating a presence or presentia. As Buck Schieffelin has argued, performance is concerned with something that analysts, anthropologists, have always found hard to characterise theoretically, the creation of presence. Performances, whether ritual or dramatic, create and make present realities vivid enough to beguile, amuse, or terrify. And through these presences, they alter moods, social relations, bodily dispositions, and states of mind. Performing with statues. The Feast of St. Paul, Festa San Paul, takes place every February in the parish of St. Paul's Shipwreck in Malta's capital, Valletta. St. Paul is not only the celebration of the local parish patron saint, but also that of the national patron. St. Paul is thought to have converted the Maltese to Christianity in the year 60 CE, when the ship that was taking him to Rome to stand trial for preaching the gospel was shipwrecked on the island. The festa begins on a weekend, 2 weeks before the feast day of 10th of February. The first function is the Hruj Talvara, the taking out of the statue, in which the statue is removed from its year-long place in a glass-fronted niche and carried shoulder-high to the main altar of the church, where it's rested for a few minutes. A prayer is said by the parish archpriest, and the congregation sing the hymn of St. Paul. The Hruj is well attended and a moment of great emotion. As the towering figure emerges from its niche, the shouts begin. Viva St. Paul! Viva l'Ashrata Malta! Long live St. Paul, long live the 10th of February of Malta. It's the first opportunity for a year for people to have approximate engagement with their saint. As the huge, probably 10-foot tall, solid wood statue is walked down the central aisle of the church, faces look up in awe and tears begin to well up. The statue is then placed on an ornate wooden pedestal in the side apse of the church, where it will rest until the final day of this festa. The Hruj is important in that it makes the statue and the saint available to everybody for a more totalised experiential engagement than is possible throughout the year. It can be walked around and touched. experiences as a saint that can't be gained in any other time of the year, while the saint is behind glass in the niche. When in his niche, contact with the saint is mediated through prayer and offerings of money and candles, placed respectively in the small metal box and the rack that sit in front of the niche. After the Khuruj, people change their way of relating to the statue. It becomes animated, as somebody to whom you can talk directly. When he's sitting in the church, people avoid turning their backs on the saint, and when they do, they'll apologize. Sorry, Paolo. These are days when special prayers can be offered to the saint, with the physical proximity signaling also a spiritual proximity or presence that assures or assumes an increased possibility of intercession. Central to the animation of the statue are a series of framing mechanisms through which it is set aside as special. Framing is discussed by Danny Miller as part of the process whereby artifacts of material culture acquire value. Framing may involve particular activities associated with an object, or just as often other objects, the sole purpose of which is to frame the main object or artifact. As in the ornate frames given to works of art, their function is to draw attention to the work itself, while nevertheless constituting valuable artifacts in their own right. Such humble objects sacrifice their own value to that of the main artifact and abound in festa. Throughout the year, the statue is literally framed by the prominent niche in which it is housed. At the end of the Khuruj, it's placed on an ornate wooden pedestal, and the space in front of it is decorated with flowers and candles, forming a space in which people can congregate to chat, pray, or simply sit and stare. The framing of the statue is a prelude to its performance on Festa Day itself. This is the culmination of a fortnight's activities, both inside and outside the church, involving solemn mass celebrations and lively brass band marches, veneration of St. Paul's relic, and elaborate fireworks displays, panegyric addresses by well-placed clerics, and performances by local DJs. Festa Day begins with the pontifical mass in the church, then the exuberant 1 o'clock march, which sees hundreds of rowdy and often drunken revelers escort the band of La Valette, which is the house band of Festa São Paulo, around the streets of Valletta. This begins and ends outside the parish church, and when it ends, the climax of festivities begin, Il Processione Talvara, the procession of the statue. The procession leaves the church just after dusk. Crowds congregate both inside and outside to watch the statue, the saint, on his way. As he's lifted up from the pedestal, there's more shouting and clapping. Magnus, magnificent one. As he leaves the church, there's a long volley of airborne fireworks, some of which light up the sky with colourful flourishes, whilst others simply explode as powerful petards. Firecrackers are set off on the roof of the church, and the saint begins his journey around the parish. St. Paul is carried by a group of 12 men, Raphia, who are specially chosen for the occasion, as both strong enough and worthy enough for this important task. Performing the task gives public recognition of their trustworthiness, reliability and strength, conveying a certain masculine status. The Raphia take it in turns. Only 8 are required at one time, and the other 4 walk alongside carrying forchina, the elaborate forked poles that are used to support the statue when it rests at street corners. Care is taken to walk in time to the brass band music that accompanies the processione, making the statue sway from side to side, although St. Paul himself were dancing. The procession stops at each street corner, and on certain corners the Raphia turn the statue around to look down the streets through which it will not pass, to demonstrate that the saint is still maintaining his patronage over the whole parish, even though he might not walk down every street during the festa. Every effort is made to animate the statue, to generate presence, or presentia, through this performance. The procession and the Raphia at the centre of it are subject to rigorous scrutiny, and numerous post-mortems are held in the parish and elsewhere in the weeks and months following festa. Video recordings are scrutinised in houses, cafes and bars to judge the success or failure of the performance in its invocation of saintly presence. Towards the end of the procession, the Raphia leave the statue to give ordinary men, and it is men, an opportunity to carry the statue. It's a chance for those who are not official Raphia to show commitment to the saint through physical engagement with his statue. Men crowd round the vara, jostling to get a position on one of the long poles on which it's carried. Each pole ends up with 2 or 3 temporary Raphia who each take a piece, yet ubicha, before returning to their families with stories of how heavy it is and what it feels like to carry. Many of these, both official and ad hoc refere, describe carrying the statue as a kind of peasants or werda, given out of gratitude or hope for intercession. The physical and symbolic subjection of the body to the trauma of being underneath the heavy statue is a literal and figurative subjection of the person to the power of the saint. This produces a kind of euphoria that many find it difficult to explain. It's described as talostia, of the host, a rather blasphemous but common phrase for amazing. One man, a regular refere, commented to me, "It's incredible, it's the biggest high you could possibly get. You get taken over by it. It's amazing, like St. Paul is with you." For regular refere, these experiences are inscribed on the body in the form of a large callus on the shoulder, referred to as a hobza, or breadbone, an index of the presence and power of the saint, his presentia and his potentia. Not only is the statue performed with, but also through this he himself performs. The power of the saint flows directly from his presence, established through performance. It's a felt power experienced by those who physically engage with the statue, either by carrying it, which is perhaps the pinnacle of engagement, or by interacting with it in other ways, talking, praying, touching, or simply gazing. If his performance is done badly, when refere forget to make him look down parish streets, for example, his presence comes into doubt and his power is diminished. This is particularly acute when bad weather prevents the procession from taking place. And each year there's a tense build-up to Festa with a keen eye kept on the unpredictable February weather. On a number of occasions I've witnessed over the last 15 years or so, seemingly settled heavy rain has miraculously cleared in time for the procession, which locals attribute to the power of the saint. On the rare occasion when the procession has to be postponed, there is a general atmosphere of gloominess, almost depression, among devotees to St. Paul until it can be successfully expedited. Without performing the procession, the presence of the saint is in doubt, and with that, his patronage over the parish and the nation. St. Paul's not the only powerful presence in the parish of St. Paul's Shipwreck. Many of the devotees of and refere for São Paulo also perform in the annual Good Friday procession and the pilgrimage of Our Lady of Sorrows held the previous Friday. The Good Friday procession, Ilha Malgbira, is a large-scale pageant and pilgrimage involving hundreds of participants, many of whom dress up as Roman soldiers or other biblical characters. Members of the confraternity responsible for the organisation of the procession walk with the procession, often hooded and barefoot, as a penance. These pilgrims accompany statues that depict the various stages of Christ's passion. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Christ bound or marabout, the Ecce Homo, Veronica, Christ redeemed, Christ crucified, Our Lady of Sorrows, and Christ's tomb. The procession is an emotional counterpoint to the enthusiastic and joyful atmosphere of Festa. It's a slow pilgrimage with funereal music and an atmosphere of solemnity. The statues don't dance, but gently sway as they make their way through the streets. The pilgrimage of Our Lady of Sorrows is, if anything, even more solemn. On this day, thousands of penitents follow the statue of Our Lady of Sorrows on its route around Valletta, often barefoot, reciting the rosary over and over. The Good Friday procession begins and ends from the Franciscan convent church of Our Lady of Jesus, known locally as Tajizu. Like the Church of St. Paul's Shipwreck, this dates from the late 16th century, in the early years of the building of Valletta. Its dedication to the union of Mary and Jesus, accomplished through the dedication of side chapels to Our Lady of Sorrows and the Holy Crucifix, earned it the title della Passione. The Passion, the Crucifix and the Virgin were therefore brought together as a central devotional triumvirate. This was consolidated with the arrival of a new statue of the Crucifixion in 1636. Within 10 years, the dedication to the new crucifix had been institutionalised with the establishment of the Confraternity of the Holy Crucifix and the Passion of Christ, which is now responsible for taking care of the crucifix, the Good Friday procession, and the statues of the Passion that are processed on that occasion. The statue is powerful. It's carved from olive wood and credited to a Sicilian Franciscan lay brother, Father Umile de Petralia Soprana, who sculpted a number of similar crucifixes in the early 17th century, alongside his brother, who was also a sculptor. The Valletta statue, though, is a particularly brutal and arresting depiction of the crucifixion. Standing life-size, the contorted and emaciated Christ oozes blood that pours down his torso in red lacquered rivulets against a parchment skin that has peeled off in places where he's been flogged to reveal raw flesh beneath. The crown of thorns is a halo of 6-inch nails jagged into the scalp, with two puncturing downwards through his brow and reappearing from the top of his eyelid and almost into his eye. On his chest, a blackened, open gash has blood cascading down. The blood on his shoulders mixes with his hair to complete the depiction of the abject. It's queasily Baroque, and the sheer corporality of the image is a source of fascination. Rumour has it that inside Christ's mouth there is a thorn sticking down from the roof of his mouth to his tongue, which is presumably poked right the way down through his head. But the fascination with the head of the crucifix doesn't stop there. It's also said that the head of the statue was completed by angels. Father Umile had carved the legs and torso of Christ without incident, it said. But when he came to the head, he fell into a trance, waking to find the head complete, the work of angels. The crucifix, then, is the result of direct holy intervention, miraculous in its creation. As an artifact acknowledged to be miraculous, the crucifix is an index of power, potentia. Its very existence shows the powers of the angels to intervene in the creative process. It also has an arresting power to command our attention. The depiction of pain and suffering, the mixture of sweat, hair and blood, has the power to move even sceptical viewers of the statue. When I was conducting anthropological fieldwork in Valletta in 1993, I was moved by the statue. In the lead-up to the Easter procession, the niche that holds the crucifix is cleaned, including the glass at the front of the niche. The glass is important. Some locals suggest that it's there to protect the statue, not from environmental damage, but from supernatural attack from the glances of those with the evil eye. Others suggest that it's there to contain the power of the statue itself and to prevent other people than members of the confraternity from gaining access to that power. For not only is the crucifix miraculous in its creation, it also possesses miraculous powers of healing. During the annual niche cleaning, cotton wool wadding is dabbed onto Christ's bleeding wounds to soak up this power. The wadding is then kept for circulation among the sick to dab on their own wounds and heal them. After this was done in 1993, it was suggested that I should climb up into the niche and help clean the glass on the inside of the niche. Contact with the miraculous statue, I was told, would help me after I'd left Malta. I climbed up next to the statue and the glass was rolled back into place. I was trapped. In the heat and the humidity, the strong musty smell of the statue and its lacquers mixed with the cleaning fluids on the cloth that I'd been given, and as I started to wipe the glass, I became increasingly aware of the figure behind me. An intense feeling of excitement overcame me. My stomach tightened, I began to shake. My heart pounded and I felt faint. Now, I discussed this experience at length with my friends and informants in Valletta. Although there were some sceptics, even among this dedicated group of confraternity members, who said it was the humidity, the cleaning fluid, and so on, others were sure that I'd felt the power of Christ. Such experiences were common, I was told, and were evidence of the statue's power to perform miracles. They were evidence of the presence of Christ. The statue was seen not merely as a depiction or representation of Christ, but an embodiment of his power and evidence of his imminence. Mario Paniola argues that Catholics live in an enchanted world in which the presence of God and the saints is constantly making itself known. For Catholics, he argues, the power of God lurks in the material world, such that the experience of the world is an essential aspect of Catholicism. In Malta, this world is populated by statues and other manifestations of the divine, and the feelings which go along with the engagements with them is commonplace. During rites of passage, such as the confirmation rite undertaken by 11 and 12-year-olds, when the archbishop lays his hand on the heads of initiates, during more regular ritual occasions of Holy Communion, God's power is felt. Informants have reported an intense feeling or shockwave emanating from the archbishop's hand, and a feeling of warmth, a tingling sensation when the consecrated host is ingested during communion. Where Christ is present in the host, in the crucifix worn around the neck as spiritual companion and protector, and in artifacts such as the miraculous crucifix, his power is felt. The statue of the miraculous crucifix is not one that is performed with, but one that itself performs acts of healing, and whose transcendent power is imminent in the world. His performances, although powerful, are nevertheless invisible. We know of the power because of its consequences, the inculcation of powerful feelings, or the healing of medical or social ills. However, other statues, such as the one bought by Angelique Caruana's wife, perform visible acts of moving, bleeding, weeping. The power of the miraculous crucifix and the passion radiates outwards through the performance of the Good Friday procession, but most particularly in the pilgrimage of Our Lady of Sorrows. The sorrowful Virgin is a realization or culmination of her maternal destiny as she makes the ultimate sacrifice of hers and God's Son for the good of humanity. She's depicted as a seated and haloed queen, holding the nails of the cross in her hand and gazing up to an empty cross with a jewel-encrusted dagger thrust into her chest. Devotion to this Virgin is widespread, as manifest in the huge crowds of penitent that her pilgrimage attracts. However, it's Our Lady of the Immaculate Conception that holds a particular place in the popular Catholic imagination. If Our Lady of Sorrows represents the realization of the Virgin's destiny, then the Immaculate Conception is the point of origin, the devotion that allows the life of Mary and her sacrifice to unfold. As one Maltese informant, a member of the confraternity of the Holy Crucifix, and a man fiercely devoted to Our Lady of Sorrows, explained, "For us Catholics, the Virgin Mary, or Madonna, is almost the most important. After all, she's the mother of Jesus. But not just a mother like your mother or my mother. No, she's the mother of the Son of God. And she's immaculate. Do you know what that means? She has no sin and is full of grace. That's why she's important for us." The doctrine of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary is central to the modern Catholic visions, such as those of Angelique at Bourges in Nadur. The doctrine holds that, like the head of the miraculous crucifix, Mary herself was created by divine intervention. Although conceived through sexual intercourse, she was from the outset filled with divine grace and therefore free from any trace of sin. This doctrine was confirmed as infallible dogma by Pope Pius VII in his Ineffabilis Deus of 1859. 1854, 4 years before the vision of the Virgin at Lourdes. The central message of this vision was a confirmation of the dogma, as the Virgin told the young Bernadette Soubirous, "I am the Immaculate Conception." Carroll has argued that there is reason to question the association of Bernadette's visions, which he calls hallucinations, with the Virgin Mary. Initially, Bernadette referred to the girl she saw as Aquero, meaning her or that one. And it was only the reference to penitence and later, "I am the Immaculate Conception," that confirmed the presence of Our Lady. This was after a period of 6 weeks or so since the first apparition, after she'd initially been punished for talking about the visions, but then attracted attention from local priests and others who made the suggestion that Aquero was in fact the Virgin. Carroll suggests that because of the regular Feast of the Immaculate Conception and the recent local minting of a commemorative medal of the Immaculate Conception, the notion of Immaculate Conception would have been familiar to Bernadette, even if she probably would have been ignorant of the details of the doctrine. It therefore served as a prototype for both the appearance of and the identification of Aquero, once the suggestion had been made by these powerful figures around her that the person she had seen was the Virgin Mary. Carroll's interpretation points to the importance of existing imagery in the development of narratives of saintly visions. Like Bernadette before her, Angelique would certainly be aware of the centrality of the Immaculate Conception, not only in Catholic doctrine and popular understandings of the Virgin, but also in the etiology of visions. Lourdes is the most famous vision in Europe, with Medjugorje a second close. And partly because it was very early confirmed by the Church as a genuine vision, was able to grow into what is now a major commercial pilgrimage centre. Just as it's no surprise that his Virgin, Angelique's Virgin, appearing after a recent trip to Medjugorje, brings messages of peace, conversion, and the family, all themes that Our Lady of Medjugorje have developed, it's also no surprise that the statue at the centre of his visions is that of the Immaculate Conception. Angelique's statue doesn't provide invisible performances of healing or intercession. It performs visible acts, crying blood and secreting oils and other fluids. Since the initial appearance of blood in January 2006, fluid has been found secreted on a framed photograph of the statue and on a set of rosary beads given to Angelique by his guardian angel. The statue was placed in a sealed glass box and the photograph in two sealed plastic bags. Soon the plastic bags showed signs of burning, while the glass case burst, mixing broken glass and liquid on the floor of Angelique's house. Salt then began to appear at the base of the statue, and a YouTube video of the statue and apparition show several gallons of liquid, which looks like oil, that's been collected from the statue since it started to perform. Now, that statue should be capable of such dramatic material performances is in keeping with Pagnola's understanding of Catholicism as a fundamentally material religion. Statues are not merely artefacts, but are substantive embodiments of saintly presence, which are both conduits of spiritual power and agents of such power in and of themselves. They're agents in the sense understood by Gell, endowed with the capacity to act, and their presence is confirmed through their being performed with and through their own performances. As such, they combine presentia and potentia, presence and power, to unite transcendence and immanence. Writing of the moving statue of Our Lady at the Ballinspittle Grotto in County Cork, Ireland, in the mid-1980s, Iper argues, and this is a quote, "To say in these circumstances that stone is made spirit is not to suggest that our masonry ceases to exist as matter, even in the minds of the most ardent of Our Lady's advocates. It is to suggest, however, that the laws of physics are answerable to those of metaphysics, an ulterior authority with the power to intervene or not at will. A material object behaving in a supernatural way both attracts attention to itself and beyond itself." End of quote. Now, I've deliberately not delved into questions of authenticity in relation to the case of Angelique Caruana. This is partly because the church and broader scientific community, including myself, are currently engaged in but not finished an interrogation of the case. It's also partly because, as Iper has pointed out, forms of iconoclasm which question authenticity effectively acknowledge the power that they seek to question. Their power lies not merely in their meaning or symbolism, but in their materiality. So much so that two detractors of the Ballinspittle Virgin, bent on releasing the hold that the statue's cult had over local Catholics, were moved to smash the face of the statue with a hammer, in full view of her astonished and horrified devotees. Now, that this attack didn't shake the conviction of the cult's members is seen by Iper as evidence that the statue was merely an emblem of her. I'm not so sure. On the one hand, the transcendent power that manifests itself within such material artefacts can certainly appear elsewhere. The destruction of a particular virgin will not shatter a devotee's commitment to the virgin. On the other hand, the immanence of a particular manifestation of this power, which has particular local and historical significance, linked to particular narratives, personalities, and politics, cannot be overlooked. These tensions between the universal and the local, the transcendent and the immanent, are central to Catholic understandings of the world, indeed, to the very definition of Catholicism itself. The end.
Right, the floor is open to discussion.
I just want to ask you a question about what you mentioned earlier about your fieldwork in Valletta. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about the Raffia, you mentioned that when they are selected, they're selected in terms of, one, being strong enough, and two, of being worthy. Now, within the context of that part of Valletta, during your fieldwork, what did you identify as characteristics that would make those men worthy? And keeping that image in mind, how does this really conform to a more global picture of what creates someone who is worthy of such a role?
Okay, worthiness is primarily reliability, commitment, being there, not being flighty. I've written about this quite a while ago, thinking about it as a particular form of kind of masculinity that is to do with a commitment, a devotion, being around, not disappearing when it's your responsibility to kind of be there. Being around to make the correct preparations in the lead up to the festa, being sociable in particular kinds of ways, that all kind of characterizes sort of worthiness, a kind of public masculine face, I guess. How that relates to global notions of worthiness?
Global in the sense of in sense of Malta. In terms of, if we're talking about, in terms of Christian morality, does it really run parallel with those characteristics? I mean, I'm keeping in consideration that, for example, that part of Valletta has a certain reputation. So I'm also keeping in mind whether these characteristics really contradict certain social reputations that these people might have within that context.
Okay, in that context, these are people who would be regarded as being good people. They would be regarded as being morally upright, as being, as I say, reliable men of a particular type, you know, kind of pillars of the community, if you like. From outside looking in, they might be regarded in slightly different terms, but in terms of the actual axis within Valletta itself or within St. Paul's shipwreck parish itself, they're people who the polite would recognise as being good men, not necessarily well educated, but certainly not hamali, you know, not low, not rude, not, you know, people who could be relied upon.
John, you mentioned before, you actually mentioned YouTube. Mm-hmm. And you quoted from a blog. Mm-hmm. These are obviously popular places of communication. Now, in the presentia of saints, in their manifestation to the popular people through what we can now call a virtual idiom, which is used by many people in the sense of networking, like Facebook, has there ever been any reports of this saintly intervention through that? And if so, could there be some, I don't know, new way of connection, some new way of intervention exactly through a sort of ether world?
I think potentially yes. I mean, this is a very big and new area kind of research, partly for me, but partly more generally, looking at mass-mediated religion, or not mass-mediated religion, but web-based mediated religion, religion on the internet and so on. And there are, you know, websites with blogs dedicated to, you know, kind of various visions, including the one here. That's one of the things that I'm kind of hoping to look at, is looking at thinking through the kind of relationships between, you know, presence and mediation in those kind of contexts in two kinds of ways. One, in the kind of way that you're thinking about, you know, is it creating a new forms and different ways of kind of being present and so on. But also in another sense, in that it does something new with, I mean, what Zimda Swartz calls the kind of development of a vision narrative. And vision narratives, and I mean, she argues that, you know, if you look at Lourdes, but in particular, you know, kind of Medjugorje, the significant thing about the ways in which the narrative develops is important, and who kind of intervenes in the development of that narrative. Now we've got new technologies, we've got new ways in which that narrative can develop, just as there's a Blogspot, there's YouTube, there is also a Facebook group, you know, around Angelique and the Bourdieu Nadeau visions. So yeah, very interesting area.
So it's not only, basically, what I mean to say is that it's not only the blogs and the communication, but actual saintly intervention through. Has any of that ever been reported yet? Some kind of mysterious, just out of curiosity. And is it a possibility?
I think it is a possibility. I think it is a possibility. Certainly in other contexts, in other religious contexts, there, you know, definitely miracles have been done on the net.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you a trivial question. When you were reporting what the people say when the statue of St. Paul comes out, you said, if I heard correctly, Viva l'Ashra Tamalta. Now, that is not good Maltese. You translated it, actually, I think, as the 10th of Malta or 10th of February, but you didn't mention February in the Maltese. I mean, I can very well imagine people saying, Viva l'Ashra Tafrar. But I very much suspect that what they are saying is what I hear them say every year, Viva l'Ashra Tamalta. The light of Malta. Viva l'Ashra, not l'Ashra.
Thank you. Thanks.
I'd like to come back to the notion of performativity, as defined by Bob Postlethwaite, particularly in the book of the same title. You were speaking of, but before I go to that, Father Peter made me think of one thing. I have two questions with regard, trivial questions again. I don't think people actually touch the statue of St. Paul. They touch the base, if ever. And the whole concept of taking over the statue is exactly the physicality is very important, which is the fact of going back to the church and therefore taking over the carrying of the statue means getting closer in proximity and therefore establishing a physical communication and contact. So, but the actual statue itself, I don't think you actually touch. In fact, one day when it rained and the statue was took refuge, at, as they say, at St. John's, one of the things that the parishioners were actually doing was touching it because it was low and they could get to it. And they were saying, Messena, Messena al Paolo. So that was important. And also, one thing you might have wished to talk to, I had referred to it myself in an article which I had written about processions, which is the fact of the inside space and outside space being linked through the voices calling to Paolo from the outside before the procession actually comes out. And therefore, this calling out to him from the outside while the song, the final songs in the church are being sung before the beginning of the procession, is a way of mingling the two spaces. Interestingly, it's generally done by women with very loud voices, you know. However, coming back to the notion of performativity and presence, I think what one also has to remember is the importance of the marches, in the sense that the marchiate during the week are a build-up to presence because they create anticipation. And therefore the final day when the saint actually does come out is the end of a long sequence suggested presence through the band. In a sense, the band incorporates the element of presence, replacing the saint up to a certain extent. I mean, not quite, but you know. And therefore, I believe that it's an important factor to take account of, because even the March Danartahat on Sunday which is, I mean, that's the sort of epitome of all these mini marchiates that happened during the week. I'm not sure if the more solemn part starts in the evening, but certainly the March Talof Sinar is a serious highlight in the fest. In fact, in San Lawrence, where they differentiated it and they put it the day before, because otherwise it was too unsacred, you don't have the same atmosphere as you have in Valletta. Mm-hmm. I thought that was important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. It was something which I haven't gone into here, but actually is in the paper that Paul mentioned at the beginning of the session, precisely around the tension and integration between inside and outside, and you know, the extent to which that becomes set up right at the very beginning as a kind of problematic, and then kind of resolved at the end through the procession. Yeah, but thanks.
Another two trivial observations I would like to make, and perhaps you can even correct me in this. First of all, about the word Magnus or Magnus, which is shouted out to the statue. I am under the impression that if translated is as magnificent, but I think the way how they are using it is more than that. It's being used as superlative, in the mm-hmm. sense this is the biggest mm-hmm. in relation to other statues or in the parish. Mm-hmm. Not just that he's magnificent, but also he is in a superlative manner. That is the impression that I have, especially from discussions in relation to others. Perhaps I am wrong. But the second point is perhaps the procession of St. Paul's represents a unique occasion also, where you've got a procession that goes out of the parish boundaries, mm-hmm. which is normally is not the case. Mm-hmm. This is one of the few, before even I think St. Augustine, the feast of St. Augustine in Valletta too, used to go out of the parish boundaries. St. Paul remained going out of the parish boundaries. I think this is a unique aspect of this procession.
Magnificent, great.
I think it's rather important that it's the great one, mm-hmm. not magnificent. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a biblical, of course, expression, and not
true. The other point about St. Paul going out of the parish, I mean, I think that is important, yeah. And that's part of, you know, very much part of the narrative of St. Paul as the national patron, as well as, because obviously occupying national space, which, you know, those streets in Valletta are.
John, I'm going to wrap myself for a minute in the mantle of Evans Pritchard and Leanhart, who, as we know, were not merely Catholic anthropologists, but they were converts to Catholicism, partly, if only partly, as a result of their work with the religions of other peoples. Now, you've presented an overview of a miraculous appearance as well as of performing statues. But a Catholic might wish to argue that the perhaps the most telling point in your talk was that point at which recent research has suggested that priests intervened between the initial phenomenological perceptions of Bernadette and the later moment, weeks later, when she started to talk of this vision as being the Immaculate Conception. And of course, the suggestion of your author was that, in fact, local priests had, in fact, interpreted this as the recently announced doctrine of the Immaculate Conception taking embodied form. And of course, we know in the case of Medjugorje, from really solid books written about Medjugorje, that of course the visionaries are associated with the Franciscans, who are in a very tough attitude of opposition to the local bishop, who, as you also know, has been systematically skeptical about these visions, as have bishops in various parts of the world. The point I'm trying to make here is that a Catholic might wish to say that this is the telling area of your talk, that if historically and empirically it could be shown that there are visions which are initially or originally of the Virgin in the minds of these visionaries, then these are cases which would deserve the closest inspection. And of course, I suppose the second point which Catholics would like to say about these visions is that they tend to occur to the poor, the marginalized, if you will, the dispossessed. So I suppose a Catholic would want to say that the jury is still out. Of course evidence is germane. Of course evidence is relevant to the phenomenology of these events, which is the focus of your talk. But provided that that hurdle can be overcome, provided at least some of these visions purport to be of the Virgin from day one, then I think we're up against the miraculous, in whichever sense you wish to use that term, the inexplicable. I don't know what anthropologists, if there is any anthropological debate on this, you see. I mean, I don't know if there's any, if there has been a riposte to your kind of point.
Which part of my particular point?
This point about the general point that this, if we're going to do a phenomenological analysis of these visions, we must end up by saying that there is a purely material or empirical explanation.
I'm not sure whether you necessarily have to go that far. I mean, I'm not sure whether you necessarily have to. In a sense, what I was trying to do at the end was actually not step into that question about authenticity, particularly in this case, because we don't know yet, because you know it is kind of undetermined. Having said that, the ways in which other visions have been dealt with and have been talked about, both ones which have been confirmed by the church and ones which haven't been confirmed by the church, do suggest that they're very, very contextual. And they're historically contextual and politically contextual and contextual in all kinds of ways. That's not giving you an answer, but I don't want to give you an answer just now.
When you were talking about the object, I was thinking all the time about psychological and psychoanalytic theories. Now, I'm not, by the way, an expert in this, so I might be making a real mistake, but I was thinking of object relations theory, mm-hmm. where in understanding how human persons develop, you understand how they attach and separate from an object, most typically a mother, but also other people, and that those people who don't manage that passage or that transition successfully have problems in what we call, I don't know, Ronnie might correct me here, he probably knows more from his old guidance and counselling, have problems in making this separation because their attachments are also problematic. And so I was thinking of the object, the statue or whatever it is, as being important or giving people attaching meaning to it as an object in this sense, for how are they going to learn first attachment and then separation, and in a sense as a transition object, as one would imagine someone with a security blanket. We know children have them as a transition object, and when they make the transition they don't need the blanket. But it seems to me, could the question be that some Catholics haven't been able to make the transition?
It could be. I mean, I would need to. It would need more knowledge of psychoanalysis than probably I've got, and probably need to. I would need to be more convinced of the kind of applicability of psychoanalysis in that universalizing kind of way. As an anthropologist, I'm kind of have an inherent skepticism about psychoanalysis, precisely because of its universalizing kind of tendencies. But there may be elements of what you're saying which might work.
Just one more point. You talked about these statues having agency, mm-hmm. and I'd like to refer to the work of one of your colleagues, Jock Stirrat, mm-hmm. With Roman Catholics in Sri Lanka, and he talks about, as well as Obey Sacre, in the same context, talks about certain statues and certain figurines having the same form, being attributed with the same form of agency. Mm-hmm. But in this case, people also refer to these statues or go to these shrines and statues to settle feuds in terms of looking for justice and looking for revenge. Now, within the context in which you've done your fieldwork, have you ever noticed any of any similar situations where these statues could be used as a sort of a means of acquiring a revenge or as a form of justice, not revenge directly, but as a form of gaining justice when...
Not in that direct sense, because, I mean, the power, although it's there, is not something over which you can have any control. What you're talking about is a form of, kind of manipulation of the object, I guess, in order to solve a particular problem. I mean, approaching...
In fact, yes.
It's a process which is approaching a form of sorcery, you know?
In fact, yes, that's... Yeah. That's
I've not seen people doing that, no. And I think people would find it very problematic to think that they might.
All right. Thanks.
This is pure speculation on my part, but I was very surprised that we were in Malta now seeing a new Virgin at Borchinadur. And actually, one thing I think might be interesting, I haven't done it myself, but would be to trace the Virgin scene in Malta vis-a-vis the Virgin, the dates of the Virgin scene in Malta vis-a-vis the Virgin scene abroad. For example, if we take the Tapino one, like more or less what period that was, and see what apparitions at the time were happening. It's interesting to know, this is just a little bit, it's not totally out of subject, but the first thing I saw in walking into a church, I thought I was having visions. I walked into a church in Tunis, and the first thing I saw was a Tapino painting, and on the whole chapel dedicated, and I said, gosh, this Virgin really looks like Tapino. I really must be nostalgic for Malta. And then I walked into the sacristy and I saw another Virgin, which was Talmelleha. And I said, I really have visions now because this is Talmelleha. And I sort of was speaking to the priest and I said, you have two Virgin Marys. They really resemble Maltese paintings. I said, no, they are. They were actually brought over by the... So the importance of this Virgin cult, and also particularly the Tapino one, which has a whole chapel, even as an export, is an interesting point, because in Tunis, this was an important church. It had a whole chapel dedicated to it, and therefore, this concept. This had led me now to think of the notion of importation and exportation of vision, and therefore of the miracles that go with that vision, sort of. I wonder if one can think of it. It's just a suggestion.
I think it's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, I think you're talking about two related but slightly different things. One is about the kind of the history of Maltese visions and their correspondence to other histories, and are they preceding or proceeding other famous visions kind of elsewhere and what have you. The other is about the kind of, kind of portability of particular representations, which I think is an interesting kind of question. One of the things that I kind of had thought that might be a way to go, anthropologist Dan Sperber has developed this notion of an epidemiology of representation, trying to kind of trace the epidemiology of particular representations and so on. It's something which Alfred Gellin used to talk about tattooing, actually, across Polynesia, about how the particular representations, kind of move and so on. And I think that might be something that you could start to think through these sorts of processes with, but it's early days.
I just wanted to ask you whether you have thought about the aesthetic quality of statues. Mm-hmm. Now, because it happens that the St. Paul statue is probably the most important piece of sculpture which we have in Malta. Mm-hmm. Now, because it was done by Gaffa, who was considered the rival of Bernini in his day. And the art historians undoubtedly regard it as the most important sculpture we have in Malta. but obviously many of the other statues. And then when we come to the sort of statue which occurs in the Angelic Caruana thing, it's kitsch.
True.
Do you think this has any...
I think power does come from aesthetics, and I mean that's partly what Jell is trying to do in his argument about agency, to say that actually it's the aesthetic capacity of particular representations to affect one, and that's partly what I was trying to kind of demonstrate with the description of the miraculous crucifix as well. It is a particularly arresting representation. There is an aesthetic kind of quality to it, comes in. Thinking about that, then the relationship between those aesthetics and the kind of kitschiness of the Angelic Caruana would be an interesting one. You know, maybe have different phenomena going on.
It's more an emotive effect rather than an aesthetic effect, which he is trying to provoke.
I think it comes down to the imaginability or otherwise of particular of the kind of the possibility of human origin of particular representations. There has been work done on this around kind of creativity and the creative process. I've looked at it in terms of mask makers in West Africa and so on, the Dogon. And they took the ways in which the kind of discourses around creativity. At what point do they know that they are creating a particular powerful mask? It's the point at which the creative process has them entering into some kind of extra state or different state, which is perhaps what Fra Mulo, where he was, and the kind of the ecstatic process of creativity of that power. I think that's what it's to do with.
Regarding the making of art in terms of its contemporaneity of the time, because art is created in a language which artists are very often unaware of themselves, and yet is a reflection of what is happening around them. And if there is a contemporary expression, such as what we now call, in retrospect, the Baroque, which also includes some extremely sadistic visions of saints being not only killed, but very cruelly flayed, tortured, and humiliated, this is something which would be used to great emotional effect by the popular artist, precisely for the reason of gaining more emotional response from an audience. And it would be that which would be, rather than an aesthetic evaluation, it would be the emotional feedback. And this would be something which could be used, I would imagine, in contemporary, in the way that a contemporary expression would also be conceived, and also in possibly a contemporary kind of medium. It doesn't have to be an actual touchable thing. In our society now, as the medium has changed for many artists from being something physical to something which is projected, surely the medium could be changing all the time. And this is something which one has to, sort of consider if you're talking about the visual as being being something which carries the spiritual, as a way of projection. It's a kind of advertising. Comment.
It's a kind of thing, yeah. I mean, yes.
The point which I was
which I was trying to make in distinguishing between the Gaffa St. Paul and the Frau Umele crucifix, because it's not actually what's used in the procession for the statue of the crucifix. Is that precisely the Frau Umele one has these characters which you're talking about. That is, it's a mainly emotional thing. It's what is done there seems to be a mechanism to work upon people's emotions. But this is not at all what there is in the St. Paul statue. I mean, there's an aesthetic which operates in the way in which great works of art operate, not in this direct emotional appeal. And I would, but they are in fact different. I mean, one is something which touches you because you see an image of somebody suffering, so you empathize with that suffering and so on. While the other is not showing you that, it's showing you a rather abstract image.
Just a few historical reflections, which I think will help us also with the argument that developed at this moment. First of all, the first historical reference for a processional statue go to 1592, and the statue now is lost. It was destroyed during the Second World War, and this is in Birgu, in reference to a statue of Saint Roch, which was taken out during the plague. And it was just only for devotional reasons, without any, it seems, even if you look at the documents, emotional relationship with the statue. And this sort of representation will continue to find it in the 16th and 17th century, and even up to the 18th. I think the biggest development occurred in the 19th century. And this brings in another motive behind the statue, and this one is political. In the 19th century, in my opinion, there was literally an explosion of statues in Malta, processional statues, every confraternity having its own statue. And this was creating a lot of trouble to the to the English, or the British here on the island. First, because there was the issue that they were Anglican, and they there had heard sermons every Sunday against this representation as pagan. And the soldiers then had to go out and had to stand to ease and to attention because the statue was going through. And I think this also helped in the emotion of the people, because I think politically we have here also an issue of identity. That was the only way how they could express political resistance to another foreign occupier in the country. I think this is another aspect which helped in the development of processional statues, which, for example, explain why there is certain feelings of St. Paul are of a certain type, and you don't find these feelings related to the statue, to the Frau Umele crucifixion. Incidentally, the devotion or the, let's say, supernatural powers described with in relation to Frau Umele, in my opinion, they developed in Malta after two crucifix, war relics, arrived in the island towards the middle of the 17th century, around 1660s. And they came from Candia, and probably they were Venetians, Greek Venetians, who were escaping because Candia was being under siege by the Turks, escaping from that country to Malta. One ended in Bormland, and the other one ended in Birgu. And the one of Bormland, you'll find it continuously in the records, was attributed already at this period miraculous powers. And definitely it shows that this crucifix had already such attribution in Candia. Eventually, this miraculous powers, nowadays no one associates the crucifix of Borno with any miraculous or supernatural powers. And I think this also explains why then eventually another crucifix in Valletta will also begin to have this sort of relationship. This is from a historical perspective.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the historical period in the 19th century obviously is the period of expansion, not just of statues, but of, you know, festi, band clubs, you know, etc., etc. It's the whole process when that's happening.
Any further comments or questions? Well, John, we really want to thank you very much for a very stimulating and interesting exposition. It's a topic of interest to everyone from many, many different points of view. And we also thank the discussants for contributing their points, which I hope you found useful. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
You have just listened to a talk as part of the Work in Progress seminar series entitled On Performing Statues. This talk was delivered by Dr. John Mitchell.